your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web. It's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 14 years now at the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? Today, I have an excellent show for you. And unlike everybody else, I'm not going to do a 9/11 show on 9/11. Actually, that day I'll be covering immigration. And unlike everyone else, I constantly cover 9/11 because we're living in a post 9/11 America and world. So the importance of it isn't something to talk about once a year, because we're living under some pretty strange stuff ever since it happened. So let me tell you about my guest. You've heard me bragging and talking about his book probably for the past month. His name is Kevin Robert Ryan. His book is called Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 911 Suspects. Kevin is the co-author of Journal of 9/11 Studies. You can check it out at journalof911studies.com. He is also a whistleblower from Underwriters Laboratories. He's contributed to many books, many articles on the subject of 9/11. He's made presentations around the United States and Canada. You've seen him on National Public Radio, Air America, Pacifica, C-SPAN. And today we're happy to have him here on the Maria Heller Show. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Maria. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for writing this book. I can't even imagine how long it took to do all the investigation and background on the legitimate 9/11 suspects.
Well, most of the work took about 4 years. I began looking at these suspects in 2009 and had spent 6 years before that dedicated to the scientific side of the World Trade Center and explanations for how those buildings were destroyed.
Well, you know, when I talk about the official story, I tell people it's a story, and it might as well have been Aesop's Fables for what the 9/11 Commission said was, you know, what happened on 9/11. And I know that you have, you know, you talk about, you know, David Ray Griffin, so many other people that I've had on the show through the years. And again, you know, there's no way we can do justice to this book. I want my listeners to know the amount of information in here. It's one of those books you have to keep so you can keep looking it up because it's a great reference book. So I want to thank you for writing it. Talk about a labor of love.
Yeah, no kidding. It really was. And I really appreciate your feedback on that. And I've gotten a lot of other good reviews of the book. So, you know, I'd be glad to just go into any kind of detail or overview that you're interested or your listeners are interested in hearing about the book. We can look
absolutely
at it different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was thinking since I have scheduled you for another interview next month, maybe we, if we can somehow get through the first eight chapters. But I think one of the most important things I can ask you is it's obvious that we've been deceived about 9/11. Why is that important?
Well, when I first started looking into 9/11, I was doing so because I realized that the Iraq War in 2003 was being based entirely on lies. And I think over the period of time since then, that's been completely confirmed that the Iraq War was based entirely on lies. So I started asking, you know, why was when did this lying begin? Mm-hmm. And I quickly kind of figured out that the 9/11 attacks had not been explained. And as you said, ultimately the official story was a deception, not only through the 9/11 Commission, but also through the agency that wrote the reports on the World Trade Center. And what a lot of people don't know is that deception was the sequel to several other deceptions. So what I mean is that the 9/11 Commission report gave us the fourth distinct story on how the air defenses failed on 9/11. And the NIST group gave us the third or fourth distinct story on how the World Trade Center buildings collapsed. And the reason why it's important that we realize that these are deceptions is that we've invested so much in the official account of 9/11. Millions of people have been killed. Mm-hmm. The civil rights in the United States are quickly eroding. You know, we have we've taken moral positions that we would never have taken before, the idea that torture is acceptable, and so forth. So really it's changed the United States of America dramatically, and it's changed world policy dramatically as well. So people need to know that how much they've invested in this false story, and then really dig into what might really have happened on 9/11.
Right. Well, you talk about something. I think it might have been in one of your letters I was reading this morning, that 9/11 was the origin of the war on terror. And I think that's one of the more important things, because we're all living in 24 hours of fear and terror now.
Absolutely. It was the origin of the war on terror, and it's still used on a regular basis in order to justify what I would call state crimes. For example, the National Security Agency's mm-hmm. Programs in which they're spying on all Americans on a regular basis is justified recently by saying, well, it's a means to prevent another 9/11. Well, if we don't really know what happened on 9/11, how could we prevent another one?
Right.
And the fact is we don't know what happened on 9/11. And my book is an attempt to show that independent citizens can really start looking into and conducting an investigation on their own. And together we can look at the evidence and compile it and try to come to some reasonable conclusions that maybe will help us avoid another terrorist attack and also reveal more of the deception behind the 9/11 attacks.
Exactly. You know, I was reading at Journal of 9/11 Studies that you were a manager at Underwriters Laboratories. And in 2003, you started questioning the World Trade Center investigation that was being conducted by the company you work for, UL, and the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. And that basically, that cost you your job because you started making your questions public.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. Well, I worked for UL as the site manager for the Environmental Testing Division, and I had spent a year from 2003 to 2004 looking into this idea of how the buildings could have been destroyed by fire when my company knew and had documented evidence that it had previously done the fire resistance testing for the World Trade Center steel components. Mm. And the CEO of the company had given me that information verbally and in writing, and I communicated with the head of the fire resistance division and looked into it quite a bit and ultimately wrote a letter to the government agency that UL was collaborating with on this investigation and asked for information. And when I did that, I allowed David Ray Griffin to distribute the letter, and mm-hmm. overnight it was read by thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. And 5 days later, the company UL fired me for having done that. But I really feel that it is the American public's right to know from a company that is tax-exempt, UL, mm-hmm. for, you know, if they have any evidence that fire resistance testing was done, they should reveal that. They actually claimed after they fired me that no evidence could be found, not that they didn't do the fire resistance testing, but that no evidence could any longer be found for that testing. And mm. the important point there is that one of the buildings collapsed completely in 56 minutes when the fire resistance testing showed that steel should have withstood 3 to 4 hours of intense fire in furnaces, much hotter fires than were seen on 9/11. Mm. So, yeah, I was fired for asking those questions and making them public.
All right. How'd that make you feel?
Well, two things. At first, it made me really mad because I'm an Irish American, and typically we have a response that's more we're ready to fight when something occurs like this. But really, over time, I learned that this incident just proved that there was something terribly wrong with the official accounts of 9/11 when a company like UL, which is otherwise straightforward in its work, would directly falsify mm-hmm. its work, having done fire-resistant testing for the World Trade Center, and then claiming that evidence couldn't be found. Not that they hadn't done it, but the right. evidence couldn't be found.
How convenient.
I knew there was something terribly wrong.
Right, how convenient. But don't you think that what happened to you there and your questioning there was really, in a way, why you started looking at what else is the government lying about, hiding, especially since there was so much from Bush and Cheney. I mean, there was so much resistance to even having an investigation.
Absolutely. I learned those things after, as you said, after that. I started really digging into 9/11, as many people did at that time. And, a lot of us made progress on just revealing these incredible anomalies with regard to 9/11. You mentioned President Bush and Vice President Cheney, who tried actively to prevent any investigation into 9/11. The 9/11 Commission didn't start until 14 months after in November 2002. Mm-hmm. And they actively sought to prevent it and then to limit it, and then only funded it with less than a tenth of what the government funded the sexual exploit investigation of President Clinton at. So they clearly didn't want answers about mm-hmm. 9/11.
Exactly. I remember when they wanted Tom Daschle to pretty much limit the investigation. Next thing you know, Daschle was one of the lucky recipients of military-grade anthrax.
Yeah, that is a great point, Maria, and if people don't realize it, we still don't know who perpetrated the anthrax attacks of October 2001, but it is clear that someone tried to frame Muslims in mm-hmm. in that instance. Five people were killed, and letters were sent with this elementary school scrawling trying to connect 9/11 to these attacks and Muslims to the attacks. And then, for whatever reason, they started investigating independent scientists in the United States. And the reason really was that the anthrax was traced to military installations in the United States.
Exactly. From what I understand, it was traced to Fort Detrick. And then that story went away, and so did the anthrax.
That's right. Fort Detrick, Dugway Proving Grounds, and Battelle Memorial Institute are the three primary laboratory areas that were seen to be the only sources of this Ames strain of anthrax.
Mm-hmm.
But what is important about that is that now we know that somebody was trying to frame Muslims. We know that, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't true.
Right.
So that means that 9/11, which has also been ostensibly blamed on Muslims, and I can tell you I found no evidence in my 10 years of investigation mm-hmm. that Muslims were responsible for the 9/11 attacks.
Right. And well, so, they carried that over all the way through the Boston bombing, still trying to blame Muslims, and now you look at what's happening in the Middle East and you start figuring out why they wanted to demonize them.
Exactly. We just, these people just happen to live on strategically important lands, and this cultural meme that has grown up where conspiracies can only, we're taught, can only be engaged in by these poor people who happen to live on resource rich land. That's just mm-hmm. absurd, because we know that the power rich and powerful people who are often convicted of conspiracy in our country are much more likely to have perpetrated the 9/11 attacks.
Well, yeah, and your book makes not just a good case for it, but I was like, after I read every name that you name in there and you put your story together, especially their backgrounds, which, most people don't know. I often think, when we finally realized the truth about Prescott Bush, had the American public known that Prescott Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush's father, supported the Nazis during World War II before he was elected. They never would have elected him. So
right.
you look at the, how can they keep a secret like that, obviously right in our face, but they do.
Well, the media, for the most part, is its purpose is to propagandize on behalf of these corporations, and so much of the media that people see aren't going to cover things like you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now you know it's totally legal to deal out propaganda to the American public through the media, which I think they've been doing all the way anyway. So I'm sure it'll only get worse when you. When you look at 9/11 and, you know, as David Ray Griffin wonderfully calls it, the 9/11 omission report, you come away, you know, and I thought and I remembered, you know, your book triggered a lot of memories for me because I've been covering 9/11 now since it happened. And after a while, your mind kind of gets foggy with all the details. But I remember that originally they wanted Kissinger to lead that panel. What happened to that?
That's exactly right. They did. They wanted Henry Kissinger. He was the first choice as chairman of the 9/11 Commission. And what happened is that the women, you know, I don't know if people know, but the 9/11 Truth Movement was largely begun by
the wives,
women,
right?
Yeah, not by us guys, but the women who were known as the Jersey Girls. They wanted some answers about Henry Kissinger. It was a requirement to lead a government commission that you reveal who your customers were in your business, and they demanded that he reveal his client list at Kissinger Associates. And he instead resigned because it was expected that his client list included names like Bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. And the whole Bin Laden family. You know, that's another thing people may have forgotten. You know, when there were no planes flying in the sky, we were flying the Bin Laden family out of the United States.
Absolutely. That, you know, that is when all commercial flight was still restricted in the United States. Oh. There was no possibility of non-military flight in the United States, and yet all these members of the Osama bin Laden family were flown back to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And not on military flights, on commercial flights.
Exactly. You know, I wasn't surprised, maybe I was a little surprised, when I noticed some of the connections in the book between, I want to say it was Louis Free and the Saudis. You know, we already knew, you know, I had Russ Baker on the show at his House of Bush, House of Saud, but there's good old Bandar Bush, as he's referred to, pretty much connected to some of the people you name in your book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Two people prominently. You mentioned Louis Free, who was the director of the FBI for the 8 or 9 years before, right before 9/11. He resigned, and we're not sure what he was doing in those 2 or 3 months before 9/11. But he had formed, even though he was appointed by President Clinton, a Democrat, he immediately began forming close relationships with George H.W. Bush and conservative Republicans around him. And the Saudi Arabian royalty, primarily, as you said, Bandar Bush, or Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, but also George Tenet, the director of the CIA, did the exact same thing. He was a close associate of the Bush cabal, and he was also close to Prince Bandar and to others, Turki Al-Fazail, who was the head of the intelligence group in Saudi Arabia at the time. And he had his own secret communications networks. People also might notice that at the same time, Tenet's sidekick, John Brennan, who is now the CIA director.
There's another key name, John Brennan.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about Michael Hastings, who was killed. There's no doubt in my mind that that was not an accident, the reporter. And his last piece he was writing about was John Brennan, according to his wife. And supposedly she still has the notes on that, and I think Rolling Stone is going to publish it. And now he just gets anointed at the FBI.
Absolutely. He was very close to Tenet, and so it's not surprising that he would conduct the same kind of activities or operations that Tenet would. And the two of them made it policy that they would turn a blind eye to what we could call Arab extremism, because although Muslims were not involved in the 9/11 attacks, there certainly are people from Saudi Arabia who would be willing to do extremist acts against the United States. Whether they're paid and operated directly through Western intelligence agencies, we don't know. But John Brennan was among those who would turn a blind eye to that sort of activity before 9/11.
Right. Well, you know, I've always asked the question. No one seems to have the answer, especially the government's never going to say it. If indeed, and it's a big if, 14 of the 19 hijackers was supposedly from Saudi Arabia, how come we didn't hit Saudi Arabia? Why did we hit Iraq and Afghanistan?
That's a great question, and I would add to that, as I do in my book, that although the 9/11 Commission said that the funding, the source of the funding for the alleged hijacker plot was of little practical significance. That's exactly what they said.
Right, little significance.
Little practical significance. Uh-huh. Anybody would think, well, where the money came from would be of huge significance.
Right.
Not the 9/11 Commission. They said it was of little practical significance. But where some of the money we know did come from, what we know was transferred, was either from Bandar's wife, Princess Haifa, who sent money to through San Diego to those two guys, alleged hijackers, Al-Madar and Al-Hazmi, who were living with an FBI informant at the time, and she was helping to fund them. But also the money came through the United Arab Emirates, and the 9/11 Commission went to great extent to avoid talking about the United Arab Emirates as well as their personal representative, Richard Clark, who was
former
terrorism czar of the United States.
Wow, I know. I was like, wow, Richard Clark, maybe he has dual citizenship with the UAE. You know, when you look at how deep their traitorous, and I love using that word since we're all supposed to be traitors for asking about the truth in our own country, when these traitors, you know, are all dealing with, you know, the scum of the earth, and yet they give us such an Alice in Wonderland story on 9/11 and expect that we would just buy it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. And, you know, the fact that you worked for UL and could actually see and question this, you were probably one of the first people to do that.
Yeah, but others have followed. You know, my colleague Stephen Jones is also
so many
actions run out of his job as a professor at Brigham Young University. He's still associated with the university, but the questions he was asking were just too sensitive, and they pretty much had to ask him to retire. So other people have followed in similar ways, but you're right. I was one of the first people to just say, hey, we just have to have answers here. And
right. Well, what do you think about, what did you think about the Pakistan and the ISI's part in this, which I think was the reason Daniel Pearl got beheaded? He got too close to the truth.
I think you're right. And I think that the Pakistan ISI is a group that should be investigated for a couple of big reasons, probably more than this. Off the top of my head, I can tell you that the general, Mahmoud Ahmed, who is in charge of Pakistan ISI, was in Washington on 9/11, and that whole week he was meeting with people like Porter Goss, who led the first investigation, alleged investigation into 9/11, and additionally, the Pakistan ISI was known to have been very, very much related to a network of terrorist financing network called BCCI. It was basically inseparable from BCCI. So the Pakistan ISI, which is a covert network of operatives, and this terrorist financing network, BCCI, figure in the book prominently, and the questions about why Pakistan was not investigated more thoroughly and what they were exactly doing, meeting with Ahmed.
Right.
Those things need to be answered, and I try to give some answers in the book.
Right. Well, with the BCCI, I mean, didn't the CIA have a big hand in the creation of that money laundering bank?
They absolutely did, and they appeared to be running the entire show through a Washington branch called First American. And there are so many connections to BCCI with regard to 9/11 that that I don't know if I can go into them here.
No, you could probably write a separate book just on that.
Yeah, the CIA was behind the creation and also the United Arab Emirates again, which provided the funding
right
for the operation. So,
well, you know, a long time ago, everybody wanted to blame everything on one country. And, you know, I keep telling my listening audience and sometimes even my other guests on 9/11, you know, the government has the evidence. So we can all only do the best we can with what we can do to try to figure out the puzzle, because I don't think the government's going to give us the evidence anytime soon based on the fact that JFK's papers are still locked up till 2032. But there were people that, you know, wanted to blame the whole thing on Israel, you know, the dancing Israelis, et cetera, et cetera. But I remember when I had Sybil Edmonds on the show, and Sybil told me very clearly, she said there were over 14 countries involved.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, my impression is that it was a transnational operation from what I can see, because there are just too many players from too many countries. And also, you know, if you really think about what appears to be the motive, which is basically a huge power grab, you know, it's a coup, a global coup that was conducted on 9/11, you know, these people are not so much beholden simply to their own patriotism, but to power. They are seeking power.
Right.
And, yeah.
Well, and
so
you
they
could
got
see
together
it.
And pulled off an operation. So.
Right. You could see it through, you know, the austerity going around the world, the fear, you know, the police state all around the world. You're trying to get in and out of an airport. It's like a nightmare. And no matter where you fly. You know, the little people getting squashed down, you know, the police state that is already, you know, we have militarized police now in the United States. I mean, there are things happening in this country I could never have fathomed 50 years ago, let alone today. It's like, wow, is this still America? So who would you say benefited from 9/11?
Well, I think in several ways, we have to look at certain corporations that would be a good place to start. And I name corporations, the Carlyle Group, which people, your listeners probably have heard of before.
Oh, yeah.
The Carlyle Group was run by one of the suspects in the book, Frank Carlucci. And another company called SAIC, which was run by another suspect, Dwayne Andrews, who was also a protege of Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney was his hero, he said many times. So the companies that profited through oil and gas contracts and through military contracts are one step. And, you know, as far as that goes, the military itself, I believe, had to be involved to some extent. And I'm not saying the military, U.S. military planned this, but I believe that certain people within the U.S. military were involved. And that means that for them to have benefited, the military obviously gained tremendous increases in funding, and so they were all made heroes as well. Basically, anybody who performed their job in any way, no matter if they failed completely, like many of them did in terms of air defenses and response,
right,
they were seen as heroes anyway.
Right. Nobody got fired. Nobody lost their jobs. You know, all kinds of audio tapes were destroyed. Oops, we did that by mistake. And we really had a total stand down of our entire defense system on 9/11.
Absolutely. And the 9/11 Commission points to two agencies, but yet they simultaneously praise everyone and say that they all did a pretty good job. The two agencies that, you know, it's like doublethink. The 9/11 Commission report, if people think about it, is like doublethink, which is a concept from George Orwell's book,
right,
1984, where you keep in your mind two contradictory concepts and have no problem accepting them.
Right.
So everybody failed, but yet they all did a good job, is what this
exactly
air defense.
And everybody got promotions. Well, doesn't that already speak to the fact that everybody did do their job that day?
Well, yeah, you would think so. I think that many of them were promoted, and I'm guessing they were promoted because they did their job. So
exactly.
Two of the people that I point out in the book, with regard to the FAA, for example, are a guy who was a Wall Street lawyer not long before 9/11, and just months before the attacks came into the FAA as an air traffic control specialist and became the national operations manager. It was his first day on 9/11.
Right, how convenient.
Yeah, his name was Benedict Sliney. He's just, and then the other guy is a special operations commander, military, lifetime military special operations guy, was hired again just before 9/11 as the FAA's hijack coordinator. And so I go into detail on him and what he failed to do and the very suspicious things that he was involved with, mm-hmm. including running a tabletop exercise, which others said was pretty damn close to the 9/11 plot. And so, you know, some of these people really...
need to be investigated, big time.
They do.
I agree. When I read that part, you know, you have so much information, background information, that I've not read anywhere else about Sliney. And I'm like, wow, how could it be that that was his first day on the job? What a perfect excuse for saying, I don't know what I was supposed to do.
Yeah, and my impression is with Sliney, and everyone deferred to him. He wasn't, I mean, in terms of the hierarchy, he wasn't the most highest level person, but as national operations manager, he was pretty close.
Right.
And the few people above him deferred to him and let him run the show. And the reason, I think, is that, first of all, he knew about, you know, high finance, and I believe that people should know that the CIA and covert operations are closely linked in our country to the world of high finance.
Mm-hmm.
But also he knew how to handle evidence and to basically, if necessary, suppress evidence,
mm-hmm.
and to come up with explanations that would confuse instead of answer the questions. For example, he was asked why he never made a request for military assistance throughout this entire two-hour period.
Right.
He knew planes were being hijacked. He never requested military assistance. He said he did not recall a request to ask for a request for military assistance, you know, in this sort of weird, convoluted way, as if he didn't know that he was supposed to, which the 9/11 Commission said was the standard protocol.
Right. Well, obviously, standard protocol was certainly not followed in any shape, manner, or form on that day.
It really was not. And the other guy, Canavan, in a really bizarre sequence of testimonies at the 9/11 Commission hearings, he never was asked about his role on that day, even though he was the point person between the FAA and the military. In fact, if you look at it, he is the one person that, if the 9/11 Commission story is true, should be hung up by his heels, because as FAA's hijack coordinator, he was supposed to be the one to make sure the military responded. And instead, they never even asked him what he was doing, and he offered voluntarily that he was just out of the country that morning, so many others.
Right, just happened to not be in town. Kevin,
yeah.
we're going to take a short break. When we get back, I'd like to talk about who I think, and obviously your book covers, with two of the biggest players on 9/11, and that's none other than Dick and Don. Let's not forget that deadly duo. So stay with us. Kevin and I will be right back.
Can you imagine the work and preparation that goes into producing and hosting a radio show 4 days a week? 14 years and still keeping it fresh and informative? Maria does it, and does it well. Did you know Maria also has a huge online presence and dedicates time each day to inform her friends on social media? Check her out on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and YouTube. Maria is easy to find. She uses her real name everywhere, Maria Heller. Let's create a world of our own choice and vision by joining together to support those who support truth. If you aren't subscribed to her show, select a subscription of your choice on her site at maria.net. That's MERIA.net. And join the informed, happy group of listeners. You are never alone. Now let's get back to this fabulous show.
Okay, welcome back. I'm speaking with Kevin Ryan. This just so you know, because we have so much to talk about. This is the first of two shows, so don't get I know you guys are going to say, why didn't you talk for 4 hours? Because, believe it or not, talking for one is a whole lot. His book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects. I have to tell you, if there are books in your library that you want to have till after the world ends to educate the next generation of people, this is one that needs to be there. I know I'm not going to be lending this one out. Okay, Kevin, we're back. I wanted to start. You have separate chapters in this book where you take up the 19 legitimate suspects, the insiders in the government, our own, you know, which our Constitution warned us about, okay, protection from enemies domestic and foreign. I think we have more domestic than not these days. You take each one of them and you give us like almost a biography of their life so we can follow and see how they became who they are and how they've been interconnected with each other for decades. And at the top of the food chain, because it was very obvious that on 9/11, George Bush was totally out of the loop, which is typical for him. Dick Cheney was running not only the government the whole time he was vice president, but it sure looks like Cheney and Rumsfeld were at the top of the food chain on 9/11.
They were, absolutely. And they were in perfect position to coordinate the 9/11 attacks in terms of making sure that the U.S. military could not respond, and also in terms of just if the operation was as needed to be, have fine details tuned on that day, they were in perfect position to do that. So, for example, Dick Cheney, he was the vice president, obviously. He was in the White House. He was the most important person there. And there's been some testimony given by Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta that he was actually tracking one of the planes on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some reason to believe that that's true because the Secret Service, who was working closely with Dick Cheney, they have released documents via FOIA showing that they were aware of the aircraft that were being hijacked, and they had a separate system of control. And on 9/11, they had escorted him down to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, mm-hmm. which is in the bunker, the basement of the White House.
Right.
And Mineta said that he was being given this. Your listeners may have heard this story before. Given this testimony, this information that a plane was coming in, and that there were some sort of orders that Cheney had actually given. So, and you can get the exact detail in the book, but basically it's clear that Dick Cheney was aware of some of these planes that were being hijacked and their progress on that morning.
Right, and Mineta had said to him, do the orders still stand? The closer the plane was getting to its target. And Cheney just said, you know, yeah, the order still stands. You know, the one thing they did right that day, which they're not admitting to, was the shoot down over Shanksville. You know, I was like, wow, the one thing they actually did right, because I'm sure you remember, because you put it in your book, it was 109 minutes. We had four planes flying around and no reaction. It was like slow motion terrorism that day.
Yeah, and people use a lot of excuses unofficially for why that occurred. They say, well, the planes dropped off radar because they turned off their transponders. Well, that's not the case. Planes don't drop off radar. Their identity is lost and their altitude is lost, mm-hmm. but you can still see them on radar. But more importantly, at least one of the planes, Flight 175, never turned off its transponder, according to the official story. So we watched that plane, someone did in the White House and at the FAA, fly the entire route directly into the World Trade Center and did not scramble planes in time to intercept that flight.
Right.
Well, Dick Cheney is, I think, a pretty good suspect, given that he was aware of the third plane, according to Norman Mineta.
Right. Well, what I really like in your book is that little bit of a synopsis after each person you take apart in this book, where you ask the questions that should be asked of them. And in some cases, like Giuliani, you say there's already enough evidence to at least arrest these people. But nothing happens. They become rock stars on the front covers of all kinds of newspapers and magazines.
Yeah, Giuliani is quite a case in this book, and he's really seems to be part of a number of things that were crimes even after the 9/11 crimes, including lying about the air quality at Ground Zero. But he also had foreknowledge that the buildings were going to collapse, and that in itself should be enough to bring him into court. But like you said, Dick and Don were really they were really coordinating it from the viewpoint of this book, and I think that evidence really shows that. Donald Rumsfeld was somebody who just kind of wasn't there. You know, he was going to meetings, various meetings, and curiously, he was making predictions according to these people he was meeting with about attacks happening exactly where they were happening. He was saying, you know, the Pentagon, where he was at, would be a great next target. And a few minutes later, that's exactly what happened.
Exactly. Well, he also, you know, the day before announced $3 trillion missing from the Pentagon, and then the bookkeeping section that had just been refurbished is the one that gets hit. How convenient.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of the most amazing things about Rumsfeld's behavior that day is that no one could reach him because, you know, after the Pentagon impact, after the plane allegedly hit the Pentagon, he didn't, you know, immediately go talk to his subordinates at NORAD. They reported directly to him. Mm-hmm. He was responsible for national air defenses. He didn't do anything in that regard. Instead, he went out to the parking lot and the lawn for 30 minutes and wandered around helping people in some described way, and couldn't be reached by the White House, and he couldn't be reached by the president. Basically, the National Command Authority was taken out of the picture by Rumsfeld's own personal actions. Mm-hmm. And if people don't know, as of this year, Dick Cheney has said in a Showtime documentary that he told the president to stay away from Washington, that he made those calls, sending the president flying around the country.
Right. Well, that's the other question. You know, there's another fact. They immediately scurry Cheney into a bunker. And they leave George Bush twisting in the wind in a school where everybody knew he was. And when his planes took off, there were no air fighters around his plane. His plane was flying without any protection.
Exactly. That's another one of those things that we must look at in terms of the Secret Service, which keeps cropping up throughout the book, the U.S. Secret Service. Mm-hmm. They were working with Cheney very closely on that morning at the White House. But like you said, President Bush was at an elementary school in Florida. He walked into that elementary school when everyone in government knew we were under attack in a coordinated terrorist attack. So he walked in knowing that, stayed there for 35 minutes in a highly publicized location, was not protected by the Secret Service.
And was made to look like a fool. He was made to look inept and like a fool.
Yeah, definitely. And as you said, there was no request for air cover for either his motor escort to the airport in Sarasota or for Air Force One as it started flying around the country aimlessly. Mm-hmm. So the Secret Service needs to be looked at very closely because they either failed in many ways or they knew the president was not a target.
Right. Well, you know, you talk about in your book the CIA within the CIA.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a phrase that came about, really. There was what is called a private intelligence network, and I try to give the history of this, that was formed basically after the mid-70s investigations into the CIA misconduct, which, by the way, Dick and Don were the primary White House defenders of. They were defending the CIA from the White House in those investigations. Mm-hmm. But you know, the government began to restrict CIA activities in the mid-70s because of this, and then President Carter went farther and fired a whole bunch of the Directorate of Operations people, including the guy who ended up being a leader of this private network, Ted Shackley. Mm-hmm. And the CIA within the CIA kind of refers to this private network that operates you know, off the books for CIA operations.
Well, and, you know, this Ted Shackley, his name comes up like he might as well have been James Bond because he's all over the Kennedy assassination too. You know, and because I remember his name just sticks out every time I read a book and I'm like, wow, this guy must have been like James Bond, that kind of a spy. It's like he never died and he's involved in everything.
Yeah, he's closely connected, I believe, it to several of these suspects, one of them being Porter Goss, who I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
He was a congressman from Florida, led the first joint inquiry into 9/11. They were both, have both been reported as being part of an Operation 40, a CIA assassination squad in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And Shackley also conducted operations in Kuwait, and I talk a lot about Kuwait in the book because of the leaders of the security company Stratesec, which was owned by Kuwait, and how their CEO, Wirt Walker, seemed to be operating in parallel to Ted Shackley in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, a lot of the history you put in, especially between Cheney and Rumsfeld, or as I like to call him, Dumsfeld, I did not know that Rumsfeld had actually mentored Dick Cheney. So these two have been thick as thieves for decades.
They have. Rumsfeld was is obviously older than Cheney, but and he supposedly first interviewed him in 1969 for a job as a congressional aide, and Cheney did get the job, and I believe it. And I explain this in the book. It was because Rumsfeld already knew he was going to get an unprecedented promotion to become a presidential advisor to Richard Nixon, and he did. In fact, he couldn't say so at that time, because he was still running for his fourth term in Congress. But right after he got elected in his fourth term, he quit to take a job that Nixon had just offered him, and he hired Cheney right away. And these guys operated through several kind of obscure offices of the the executive branch, one called the Office of Economic Opportunity, OEO.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these characters go back to this OEO, including Frank Carlucci and Rumsfeld and Cheney and, believe it or not, Christine Todd Whitman, who was the EPA director on 9/11.
Right.
Who
said, come on back, the air is clean.
Yeah, just like Giuliani.
She should be in jail just for that.
They really should. Those were direct lies about the quality of the air. And people say that, well, that was because they were trying to open Wall Street quicker, you know, as if that's an excuse. But I believe they were trying to speed the evidence removal from Ground Zero.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, if they cared about people's health, don't forget Giuliani wouldn't allow the first responders to wear any protection because he didn't want photographs taken that would scare people out of coming back to New York.
Yeah, he is just, he's got so many things that need to be looked into. And, you know, I go into the book again about BCCI and his connections to the enforcement actions of BCCI, and then working for a law firm, White & Case, that represented BCCI. So it's just back and forth in this weird sort of revolving door with people like Giuliani, but his connections to organized crime and his destruction of critical evidence at the World Trade Center, you know, there are just so many things with regard to him that he has to be brought to court before he gets away with dying without retribution.
Well, that's the thing. The problem is we got to worry about these people dying. And meanwhile, they're getting libraries named after them, and we're paying for their replacement hearts, which was something I didn't even think Cheney had, and yet the taxpayer had to pay for that. But what amazes me is when you look at, even in the early chapters, you know, you can look at, and I love your clever little names for your chapters too, by the way. When you look at the chapters, you see all the same players, you know, James Baker. You see all the same names, and these people have been intertwined in the, I want to think about what you called it, the overworld of politics.
Yeah.
They've been intertwined. It's like they've been patient for some of them 40, 50 years to get what they have going on now.
Yeah, James Baker is a great example. You know, he's close to Rumsfeld. They both went to Princeton. He's close to the Bush family. He worked for the Carlyle Group. Of course, he's been he held many high-level positions, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State, and you know, he's connected to so many of these people. And, you know, if people don't remember, Baker is always kind of behind the scenes, or was during the Bush administration.
Oh, yeah, he was a big Bush family lawyer and protector. He was almost like the consigliere.
Yeah, he's primarily responsible for giving us George W. Bush as president because he's the one who was able to squash the recount in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there's a special place in hell for him.
No kidding. And, you know, when you say the overworld, that's a term I actually took from another author, Peter Dale Scott, mm-hmm. in his books that go into the concept of the deep state. And I try to explain that in this book, that this combination of the CIA within the CIA and these specific royal families and specific oil-rich countries and organized crime and how they all meld together with people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Clark, mm-hmm. who were running a continuity of government program at the same time. All that melds together at the point of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the overworld then represents the interests of high finance corporate, transnational corporate interests that are really behind those people as well. And I mm-hmm. I do go in a little bit in the last chapter into some of those people. I think Henry Kissinger is an example mm-hmm. Yet another level of this overworld operation.
Absolutely. It's like, and they have their plan, like the Project for the New American Century or Agenda 21. You know, these people never seem to lose, they never take their eyes off their goal. It doesn't matter to them how long it takes. And when you mention the continuity of government, there are people now who are still questioning whether that's still in effect since 9/11. Who's running the country?
That's exactly right. And I give evidence in my book that in a year after 9/11, we knew it was still in effect. Mm-hmm. And in fact, over time, I believe even President Obama has renewed that legislation for continuity of government. The problem is we don't really know what it means and what it does, because even U.S. congressmen have been refused the opportunity to see the documents related to continuity of government. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the president can renew the legislation for another year after year, but the U.S. Congress can't even see what it means and what it does.
Well, how much does the CIA ever show Congress? Look, they were all supposedly caught with their pants down on this NSA revelation by Ed Snowden.
Yeah, they seem to be out of commission. But, you know, with continuity of government, one thing that connects it strongly to 9/11, and people should know this, is that continuity of government was instituted for the first and only time on 9/11 by Richard Clark, mm-hmm. the counterterrorism czar. And it was Richard Clark just 3 years before who had revised that plan to have it be a response not only to a Cold War sort of attack from Russia, but also to the exactly the kind of thing that happened on 9/11, a terrorist event mm. on domestic soil. So they appeared in 1998 to know that this sort of thing was going to happen and to be ready to implement this secret plan, basically throwing the Constitution out.
Of course. Look how quick they rolled out the Patriot Act. There's no way they wrote that Patriot Act so quickly and rolled it out after 9/11. You know, that was probably in the wings for quite some time.
That's exactly right. Many people have mentioned that. And, you know, I recall several of the things you said. The movie Michael Moore made, Fahrenheit 9/11, goes into that, mm-hmm. as well as the admission by John Conyers that they not only didn't read that bill before they signed it, they don't really read any of the bills.
No, of course not. Congress. They just sign whatever their two lobbyists per congressman tell them to sign.
Yeah, this, going back to this continuity of government, if people haven't heard much about this, this is a program that started in the early 80s of Reagan, and even before that, I believe, but Reagan really made it fly. It was a plan to have private citizens take over the U.S. government and essentially supersede the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. That's what continuity of government was.
Right.
And they ran exercises in which they took people, a small group of people that included Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Clark, James Woolsey, Kenneth Duberstein, people like this who were flown out to secret locations to become essentially
right.
president. They effectively replaced the U.S. government in times of crisis.
Right, unelected people, just the people that, you know, most of them on PNAC, Project for New American Century, would get their chance to be king for a day.
Yeah, PNAC figures I think, prominently, and I go into that in the chapter on the Pentagon, because there was a dozen PNAC signatories working for the Pentagon in that building on 9/11. And, you know, they were calling for it. Well, I don't know if they're calling it. They were saying the only thing that would allow them to implement their plans for a revolution in military affairs basically was a new Pearl Harbor. That's what they needed.
Absolutely. I think that was the name of the first book David Ray Griffin did on 9/11. Kevin, we're out of time, but I have to tell you, I'm looking forward to our next interview on this. I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Maria. I really appreciate it.
Me too. Take good care. Okay, Kevin Ryan, another 19, investigating legitimate 9/11 suspects. I can't tell you enough about the importance of everybody knowing what's in this book, because these are the people that should be in jail, not Bradley Manning, not Ed Snowden, not me or you. Anyway, thanks for listening and supporting the show. I will see you guys tomorrow when I'm back with Dave McGowan.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.